Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, November 7, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing the new book, Extortion: How Politicians Extract Your Money, Buy Votes, and Line Their Own Pockets. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and as always, we're recording our call for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to today's call two outstanding panelists, the author of the book in question, Extortion: How Politicians Extract Your Money, Buy Votes, and Line Their Own Pockets. He is Peter Schweitzer. He's the William J. Casey Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University. And leading our discussion today, the Honorable Eileen O'Connor. She's a partner at Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman here in Washington, D.C. She's chairman of our Administrative Law Practice Group, and she's also a return featured guest here on our program. So with that, let me turn things over to you, Lee.
Thank you, Dean. It's our pleasure to have Peter Schweitzer with us today. As Dean just said, he's president of the Government Accountability Institute and the William J. Casey Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. The Administrative Law Practice Group first thought about reaching out to Peter a few months ago to learn his views of the Stock Act, the proposal and passage of which his 2011 book, Throw Them All Out, is widely credited with inspiring. As it turned out, however, Peter was already at it again, about to publish his new book, Extortion. Throw Them All Out was subtitled, How Politicians and Their Friends Get Rich Off Insider Stock Tips, Land Deals, and Cronyism That Would Send the Rest of Us to Prison. It inspired a 60 Minutes investigation and, as I just mentioned, led to passage of the Stock Act. With Extortion, Peter Schweitzer has done it again. The book was published on Monday, October 21, and on Sunday, October 20, 60 Minutes featured it in a segment entitled Washington's Open Secret. I won't step on your remarks about which parts of your book 60 Minutes focused on, Peter, but I must admit I won't be at the least bit surprised if some remedial legislation isn't around the corner as a result. Peter accomplished something very unusual recently. On the same day, the New York Times editorial page and Sarah Palin on her website each recommended this book. Peter, your book seemed to indicate a somewhat jaded view of goings-on in Washington. Care to elaborate?
Well, Lee, thanks so much, and Dean, thanks so much for having me on this call. Yes, I mean, I guess people could say that I have a cynical view of politics, but I think what I would probably suggest is that I just have a realistic view of human nature. I think that when we look at Washington, D.C., we have to look realistically that human nature is a constant. And what do I mean by that? Well, the paradigm that we usually use to approach issues related to corruption in Washington or money in politics is what I call sort of the Mr. Smith goes to Washington paradigm, which is we tend to view people that go into public service by and large to be like Jimmy Stewart in that famous movie. Idealistic, committed to serving the general public, selflessly trying to, advance the public good. And there certainly are people that go into public service. I wouldn't say that there weren't. But my view tends to be, I think, that of James Madison and others, is that people don't suddenly become angels just because they're in public service. My view is that we have made a mistake over the last 40 years when we have focused on dealing with the issue of money in politics by focusing almost exclusively on what I would call the buyers of influence rather than the sellers of influence. And what do I mean by that? Well, I think that, in D.C. we would all agree there's a marketplace for influence and access to power. And in this particular market, most of the restrictions over the last 40 years have been on those that are interested in buying that influence rather than those that are selling, which tend to be the politicians. That's pretty unique. I think you would probably all agree that in most instances, whether it's financial markets or otherwise, there tends to be most of the regulatory burden falls upon those that are selling rather than those that are buying. In this case, I think we have this reality because, of course, the politicians are writing the rules themselves and are going to write it in such a way that it puts minimum burden on themselves. You know, well, why does this matter? I think it matters because the adage that money is corrupting politics, I think is not completely correct. I think we have a phenomenon that's going on at the same time in which politics is corrupting money. And what do I mean by that? Well, there was a survey done probably 10 years ago, the last one that I've seen, where corporate executives were asked, why do you give to political candidates when they're running for office? And over half of them said that the main reason they gave was because they feared if they didn't, bad things were going to happen to them or to their company or industry. And that got me thinking in terms of this issue of money in politics, that not everybody going into politics is like Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Stewart. Not every politician is idealistic and is just in a bad neighborhood or in a bad culture, Washington, D.C., that is going to corrupt them. But you actually do have people that are going into public service and are not only not serving the public interest, but are committed to self-enrichment, and they're using the levers of power that they possess in order to self-enrich. In other words, the transaction that takes place between money and political action or legislation is not so much the paradigm of bribery, per se, that some people have used, but it's more extortion, that politicians in Washington are, in a sense, creating a demand for their services. I interviewed several corporate executives, former corporate executives, I would say, because none of the current active CEOs or executives would go on the record. But they were very clear that this was their experience. I interviewed the former president of Shell Oil, the former chief operating officer at Microsoft, and the CEO of Microsoft said, look, the reality is that, you know, in the high-tech industry, we're not very interested in Washington, but Washington is very interested in us. And by that, he meant that with all the money available in Washington, D.C., there definitely is and was a concerted effort to create opportunities for extraction. And that's, I think, the approach that we need to take when it comes to, a reform agenda. And maybe I'll talk about that just a little bit here at the tail end. What do I mean by extortion, and what does it look like? Well, and this is certainly a risk that I take, being on a phone with attorneys who understand the law better than I do. But the experience that we've had in America on issues of extortion in general have sort of been, I think, encapsulated in my mind to the experience that we had in urban America 20 years ago with the so-called street squeegee man. Or these were these individuals that, you know, you'd pull up on a street corner in New York, a guy would, you know, suddenly appear, he's got a sponge or a squeegee in one hand and he's got a brick in the other, and he says, I'm going to wash your windshield. Well, in that particular case, they would not have to threaten or verbally say, if you don't pay me to clean your window, I'm going to throw the brick through the windshield. Everybody understood that. So it was not an explicit threat, but by the act of intimidation, it was pretty clear that people realized that this was not right, and it was dealt with and dealt with effectively. And the problem existed in New York, Boston, even some Canadian cities. They dealt with it because they saw the extortive nature of how that transaction, as it were, was taking place. Well, what we see in Washington, D.C. is oftentimes very similar. And this is what the former CEOs will say. They don't come out and say, give me money or else. What they say is, look, I won't understand your issue, or I'm not going to have time to deal with your issue, unless you're willing to help me raise money. And let me just give you sort of one example of the kind of the way that this transaction works. And this comes from a gentleman who was the president of Shell Oil. In 2009, he appeared before a congressional committee. Gasoline prices were pretty high. This committee members from both parties lambasted him and basically said Shell was responsible for, you know, the price of gasoline, you know, rising to over $4 a barrel. And there were even threats during that hearing, that, gosh, we need to nationalize Shell Oil. And you can actually find this exchange on YouTube if you're interested in it. What's stunning to me is what he said happened after the fact, which was literally the same people that were lambasting him and making these threats to impose higher taxes or to nationalize his company, literally afterwards came to him and said, you know, I would understand your issues better if you held a fundraiser for me or if you made donations to my campaign. And so in that particular case, there was no direct quid pro quo. But I think just like the squeegee men who were standing there with a cloth in one hand and a brick in the other, it was very, very clear to him what kind of transaction was taking place and what the expectation was. And there are numerous other methodologies that are used on the legislative side. Well, what are some of the other sort of forms of extortion here? And then I'll just talk briefly about some proposed solutions that I see. Well, there are other forms of extortion that exist. In the executive branch side, and on the regulatory side, there is what, for lack of a better term, I call regulatory extortion. And this, I think, relates very specifically to the growing complexity of regulatory regimes related to everything from banking matters to environmental matters. If you look at, for example, the size and scope of regulation and the complexity of it, it has expanded radically. The example I always use is, you look at Glass-Steagall, which was, I think, 35, 36 pages long, obviously had massive implications for the American financial sector in the 1930s. You flash forward now to Dodd-Frank, the bill itself is over 2,000 pages, but that, of course, doesn't even count all the rules that continue to be written. Certainly, I think part of that is because the world is more complex, but I also think there is a definite economic component that is fueling that. And I think it's evident in looking at some of the individuals who actually wrote Dodd-Frank, which my understanding from all accounts is a very, very difficult bill to law to understand and to translate. Even people that have acted in that field of financial law for the last 20 years. The individuals who primarily wrote that for Senator Dodd and for Congressman Frank, after the bill was signed into law, quit their jobs. And what did they do? Well, they basically joined or started consulting firms where they now started to advise Wall Street firms and big banks on how to comply with the law. In other words, I would argue the complexity and the difficulty in interpreting that law created enormous financial upsides for those people who wrote those bills. It's sort of the equivalent in my mind to writing legislation in an ancient language like Sanskrit and then saying, pay me a big fee and I will translate it for you into English. And that, to my mind, is an additional form of extortion because you have entities, Wall Street firms, banks, people operating in the financial sector who desire to comply with the law, but they can't understand it and they can't make sense of it. And really their only option is to go to a select group of people who wrote that legislation or who were deeply immersed in the bill writing process to actually translate it for them. So to me, that is another form of kind of extortion that's taking place on the national level. And then I guess the third component, I'll just talk about this briefly, is my concerns and its concerns raised about others as to what we are seeing at the Department of Justice as it relates to the enforcement side. Alan Dershowitz and others have written widely on the fact that there are so many felonies, there's so much in the criminal code now that by Dershowitz's estimation, the average professional in the United States, without even knowing it, is probably theoretically committing 3 felonies a day. And there's actually a book, a very interesting book that's been written on that subject, if anybody's interested. And Dershowitz's basic point is that there are so many laws on the books that if you want to find somebody on something on somebody, you just need to sort of identify the person and then start going through these statutes, and you could probably find something that could stick. That I think obviously has been, always been a an issue and a concern as it relates to legal enforcement. But I think with the expansion of the criminal code and even the civil code, it makes it a lot easier. And what you've seen, I would argue, over the last 4 to 5 years, is a Department of Justice that seems and is indeed increasingly politicized. And the example that I use here is, we're not just talking about individuals who share the judicial philosophy of the administration. That is what the Department of Justice should do. Those priorities are established by the Attorney General. The judicial philosophy should be consistent. That all makes complete sense. But what you saw in 2009 was something that was really unprecedented in American politics, and that is that the Attorney General, Eric Holder, and 5 other senior officials at DOJ were, for the first time in American history, campaign bundlers who had raised large sums of money to elect the president in 2008. That certainly did not happen in previous administrations. Certainly you had, during the Nixon administration, senior officials who, one could argue, were acting in a sort of highly politicized manner. But from the standpoint of having individuals who had exerted themselves to raise $500,000 or more for a president to win election, that is unprecedented. And what I think you see happening, and I give numerous examples in the book, is that laws like the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and others, who were largely dormant for, 30 years, and are generally sort of vaguely written in terms of what a constitutes a violation and how it can be interpreted, we have seen the use of those laws as an investigation tool has expanded enormously. And that in many cases, the companies or the sectors of the economy that are targeted have happened to be industries or sectors of the economy which have not been supportive of the president politically. And it does raise a very, very troublesome question in terms of how those laws are being used, and are they being used as a tool of political intimidation. There's also several academic studies, I cite them in the book, that look at the penalties that the SEC or Department of Justice have imposed on companies or individuals as it relates to financial crimes or civil related crimes. And the evidence seems pretty overwhelming that if you are a campaign contributor, your chances of, for example, going to jail as it relates to certain financial crimes drops astronomically compared to those who are not contributors or compared to those who don't hire, for example, well-connected lobbyists. So I don't know from that standpoint what the solution is, but it is very troubling, and I think it should lead us to look at this question of what happens in Washington, the interplay between money and politics, and question how much of it really fits the bribery scenario where companies are just eager to throw money at politicians. That certainly does happen, but I think we should also look at the larger question of are politicians and are bureaucrats or congressional staffers, in effect, creating demand for their services. Or to use the phrase from the Microsoft COO, you may not be interested in Washington, but Washington is interested in you. I will talk just 2 minutes on some solutions that I proposed, and I'd love to get questions or comments, reactions from people. My view is that there are a couple of things that we should look at doing at a very fundamental level, recognizing that there is no silver bullet. No law is going to change a fundamental reality. And I think that fundamental reality is that politicians are far more powerful now than they were 100 years ago. The average congressman has enormous power just because of the growth and size and scope of the federal government. So the ability to extract is just so much greater than it was 100 years ago. One of the things that I propose is considering doing in Washington what is done at the state level in at least 27 states, including Florida, where I live. It's also done in Texas. It's done in Washington State. In those states, the law says, or in some cases you actually have House and Senate rules that are strictly enforced, that says when the state legislature is in session, the politician cannot solicit or receive campaign contributions. Now, this is by no means a perfect solution, but a lot of people in states will tell you that by doing this, a couple of things have happened. Number one, it leads people in those state legislatures to focus far more on the legislative activity rather than dragging out long sessions, because there's, I would argue, a financial incentive that politicians have to have sort of long, drawn-out, rancorous legislative sessions. So it creates an incentive to say, if you want to raise money, go raise money. But, you know, when you're in session, you're focused on lawmaking rather than money making. The second thing that I think that this does, and there's been some evidence for this, is it takes away a little bit of the extortive component from the standpoint of timing. Yes, there's going to be pressure brought on companies and individuals to make donations. But the sort of immediacy problem, and I kind of highlight this in the book, where literally you'll have a committee, the Energy Committee, is going to have a crucial vote that's going to have long ramifications for the oil and gas sector. The night before that vote, you will have members of that committee all holding fundraisers. And you are expected, if you are in that industry, to show up and cut a check. And if you don't, that bill might be delayed, or some congressmen may not even vote on the bill, or they may end up voting a different way. There is a certain ability to leverage one's position if you are able to literally raise money at the same time as you are creating laws. So I think that reform, and there's some others that I call for as well that are maybe a little bit more minor, but I think that reform would at least have the effect of trying to change the equation and maybe in some way changing this sort of extortive culture that we have. So that's kind of my introduction. I would love to take questions or comments, Lee, if you have any or anybody else does, and reactions, and have a real dialogue about this.
Certainly. Thank you so much, Peter, for that wonderful summary. There is so much more in your book, though. You touched on a couple of the topics that were of special interest to me, pointing out that the top DOJ officials were also top Obama campaign fundraisers in 2008. And I think you also mentioned that in 2012, the Department of Justice found itself in the position of conducting criminal investigations of various Mitt Romney supporters. And you list those in the book, those people who found themselves at the receiving end of DOJ investigations. And on the flip side of that was MF Global, which lost $1.6 billion in client investments, having commingled client assets with their own, and John Corzine, at the head of that, suffered no criminal repercussions as a result. You mentioned in the book Attorney General Robert Jackson, which I always like to see Attorney General Jackson mentioned because he was my predecessor in the tax division. Many people don't know that before he became Attorney General, he was Assistant Attorney General in charge of the tax division. Another focus of your book is what we in the administrative law practice group call big bills. You mentioned that Dodd-Frank was more than 2,300 pages long and that you pretty much have to hire a Sherpa, my word, to find your way through it, and that these big bills are not only bad for a variety of very obvious reasons, but they also lend to your idea of extraction, and that is the people who were involved in putting together those bills are able to obtain pretty remunerative employment for themselves afterwards because people want to comply with the law, but they need a Sherpa to lead them through it. So those were all very excellent points. One that something in your book I found absolutely fascinating, and you just mentioned in passing, could you elaborate a little bit more on the leadership PACs and how people give money to politicians who then use it to give to each other to buy their votes?
Well, that's a great question, Lee. Yeah, leadership PACs are a very interesting fundraising tool, and I think what when you look at how they function, at least in the case of a lot of members of Congress, you quickly realize that fundraising is not just about winning election or reelection. It's also become a lifestyle subsidy. A leadership PAC, for those who aren't familiar, is political action committee that's been around for approximately 20 years. As the name implies, it initially was a PAC, political action committee, formed by those who are in leadership positions, you know, Speaker of the House, Majority Leader, Minority Leader, et cetera. And the idea is that you would raise money, and then you would use that money to help advance your party's cause. You would use it to help people, colleagues that are in vulnerable seats. You could use it to support challengers against, you know, people in the opposite party, so you could try to maintain majority or gain majority in the House or in the Senate. And I think that's how they functioned for quite a while and continue to function. I think by and large, when you look at the leadership, both parties in the House and the Senate, that's essentially what leadership PAC money gets used for. That's sort of the currency that kind of, you know, greases their rise to the top of the House and Senate. The problem is that now almost everybody and their brother in politics has a leadership PAC. And so you have a lot of members of Congress who aren't in leadership and raise money. Probably 80-90% of the money, you know, comes from corporate or labor union PACs or from lobbyists. It's not something that they're real keen to go back to their own constituents and ask them to cut checks for. And the problem is that unlike a regular campaign committee, you know, friends of Peter Schweitzer, I'm running for Congress, that has a very real restriction on the use of funds. I can't just take, you know, friends of Peter Schweitzer funds and, you know, take the family to Disney World and have the campaign pay for it. You go to jail for that. Jesse Jackson Jr. is in jail today in part because of that's what he did. But a leadership PAC is a little bit different. The FEC actually does not have any authority over how leadership PAC funds can be spent. And so what's happened is that the vast majority of members of Congress have them, and the leadership PACs end up getting used. Yes, they do occasionally give money to colleagues, but they, by and large, mostly get used to subsidize lifestyle. So, you know, members use them for international travel. They use them to rent limousines, to go to five-star resorts, to go play golf at the best courses in the world. All of this gets used under the rubric of leadership PAC money. The other thing that you find about them is that, you know, the ethics rules are very clear that you cannot, as a member of Congress, converse with an individual in your congressional office about giving a donation. You know, somebody can't hand you a check in your congressional office. They're not supposed to, and you're not supposed to solicit it. But there's an exception written into the rule, and the exception is among colleagues. So you can literally ask for and receive a donation from a congressional colleague to your campaign fund, which may not seem like a big deal. But what's happened with the leadership PACs is that they are increasingly being used to sort of maintain party discipline. And I cite numerous examples in the book. Both parties do this. Right now I give an example from Boehner just because the Republicans are in the majority. Where there's a vote where it's not clear whether, you know, the party is going to back a position that he's taken. So what they do is they send out, you know, in this case I'm thinking of, more than $400,000 in leadership PAC money is sent out to Republican colleagues on the day of a very, very contentious vote. And what's interesting about it is when you look at where that money flows, it's not flowing to vulnerable Republicans who are in borderline districts who might lose. A lot of it ends up going to members of Congress who are in very, very safe seats. And so the question then becomes why? Why the timing of that distribution of the money, and why is it going to, you know, members who are, you know, either ran unopposed the last time or are, you know, not facing any serious opposition? And when you look at the timing question and you look at who's receiving it and how those people end up voting, it's not too difficult to come to the conclusion that this is part of the, let's say, incentive structure that leadership uses to get people to vote a certain way. And, you know, to my mind, I'm somebody who believes that, you know, things like earmarks and things like that are just, you know, that's kind of part of the way the system works. You need to have some enticements. But I think when it comes to a transaction that involves passing, you know, money for votes, in my mind, it's highly problematic. And so what I've proposed when it comes to leadership PACs is changing the requirements that, in other words, leadership PACs should sort of succumb to the same kind of requirements on personal use of funds as we do with regular campaigns. That at least I think would change some of the personal use as it relates to leadership PACs.
Thank you. I've got so many more of items in your book I'd like to talk to you about, but I'm going to ask just one more question before we open it to the floor for the participants. And another thing you mentioned in your book is the price tag for committee assignments. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, this is a system called party dues. They make it sound a little bit like joining a country club. You know, you just pay your annual dues. But the bottom line is that if you are a member of Congress, you don't really have a choice to pay party dues. We actually reprint the copies for both Democrats and Republicans in the back of the book. Get both parties do this. A lot of these problems what I perceive as problems that I identify in the book, are issues that are really not about one political party or other. There's a way that the system has, I would argue, metastasized to its current point. But the party dues, and both parties are very explicit about this, are essentially a price tag for committee assignments. You know, I sort of naively believed that if you came into Congress, you were newly elected, you had a background in, say, banking, or a background in law, that you would end up on a finance committee or on a judiciary committee. What you realize, though, with the party dues is that if you want to sit on a choice committee, if you want to sit on House Financial Services, there is a price that is associated to that. There is a price tag that goes with that. And in that particular case, it's about $500,000 per election cycle. Now, this is money that you need to raise above and beyond what you're raising for your own campaign reelection. This has nothing to do with your campaign reelection committee. This has everything to do with what you are going to be sending to the party during an election cycle. And what members will tell you, particularly members who are now out of Congress, is that if you don't meet your dues requirements, they can and will take you off of a powerful committee. And again, I think the problem is, Lee, is it creates this sort of vicious cycle, because who do they go to fund these party dues? They're not going to go back to the constituents in home district and say, look, I've got to raise $500,000 so I can sit on this committee. What they do is they tend to rely on lobbyists and others who are sort of insiders in the system. And I certainly believe that lobbying is a constitutional right. I certainly don't think that it is inherently bad, but I think this kind of funding system creates a sort of reinforcement where they become dependent upon the industry with which they have oversight for the significant source of money for their ability to sit on that committee. And it's not too hard, I think, for any of us to say, you know, that just does not seem to be a good approach when it comes to getting good lawmaking in Washington.
Fascinating. Dean, do you want to open it to the callers, please?
Sure thing. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. It looks like you've poked our audience a bit here. We've got five questions to start, so let's go with our first caller.
Good afternoon. This is Bob Zadick. I'm host of the Bob Zadick Show. I'm an attorney in San Francisco. A couple of comments. First of all, just in passing, you referred early in your remarks to public service, which I always wince over. There's nothing service about it. It's just a job. There's no sacrifice involved. Just a comment. More to the point about the influence of money in politics. It seems to me, in listening to your remarks, one would think that business is, especially big business, is the victim of the extortion. In extortion, there's a victim, and one would think that business is a victim. I think it's not quite that simple. A big business, to a large degree, really benefits from and enjoys this corrupt system, because at least they know that if they pay, they can control the political outcome rather than leaving it all up to chance. So to some degree, while there's a corrupting price to it, there's a corresponding benefit. Crony capitalism is often referred to as sort of the label for it all. But I think, and I agree with you, one must focus on the seller of the corruption as well as the buyer. But here, the buyer really likes the fact that this product or service is available.
Well, I think the caller makes excellent points, and I would agree with you. I've written a lot in Throw Them All Out and elsewhere on crony capitalism, and I agree with you. There's no question that there are large corporations that, when you look at it from the standpoint of what their cash investment is, investment in quotation marks is, and their return, it's a very, very good investment. I do think, though, that that varies from industry. And I think that there are some industries, I would say high tech, for example, there are certainly legislative things that they want to see accomplished. But the ethos, at least, you know, 20 years ago, was that they basically wanted to be left alone. And a lot of the high tech industries tend to take a very sort of libertarian, innovative view of the role that they should have and contact they should have with governments. But government sees the big pot of money there and looks for opportunities to create a demand for their services. So I would agree with you completely. I think oftentimes those that are the most victimized, if we use the term victim as it relates to extortion, probably don't tend to be the large corporations. It tends to be more the mid-sized operators who really are in a position where they are over a barrel and they feel like they've got to get government to respond in a way that you know is helpful to them, but they simply don't have the pull that larger companies do. So I would generally agree with your comments.
All right, let's take another call. We've got four questions pending at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Mike Doherty in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm the author also of a book called The Devil Inside the Beltway, which I just sent you in Tallahassee. Piggybacking off the last caller's commentary, I own a pathology laboratory, and I think Obamacare and the shock of the real-world experience the public's going through is an example of medium to small businesses being so impacted and blindsided and not seeing a benefit, because I would argue most of these physician practices and physicians by and large are blindsided by this and are very victimized by this. And I think your book is a huge opportunity to put some exposure on this and educate the public. I think one of the most important things you're doing as a service is being an outsider and educating. Can you speak to who you think your audience is for this and what your goals are in broadening your message to those that aren't quite so politically involved?
That's a great question. And yes, I actually just saw the package with your book yesterday, so I look forward to diving into that. Thanks for sending it to me.
Thanks.
I think that much of the discussion and the focus as it relates to money and politics has been on the large operators, you know, the billionaires or the multimillionaires, who throw a lot of resources into super PACs, et cetera, or, you know, the large CEOs, corporate executives. I think that a lot of, people that are own businesses that are successful feel this quite a bit. And I think that there is a real opportunity to inform them of what's going on. I've had feedback from numerous people who are in this position who do not consider themselves political at all. They are pretty much in the leave me alone kind of approach, but they have a target on their back because they are successful, they have a pot of money, and that there are extortive opportunities. So my sense is that, you know, we do have an opportunity with, you know, not large corporations who already have, you know, lobbyists, who have government affairs divisions, who've been operating in this space for years. But we have an opportunity with smaller companies that are, you know, more successful recently, who are trying to find their way around. And they are frustrated because, yes, there are cronies out there, crony capitalists, who are, in effect, bribing and benefiting from this system. But that's not every businessman. And those that are sort of highly innovative and recently successful, you know, just by providing goods and services in the marketplace that people want, do feel frustrated because they do want to be left alone and they can't get government and politicians to an effectively work. So that's, I think, probably the audience that the book will resonate with the most is the entrepreneur.
Let's go to another caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I wonder if you're aware that this is sort of thing has been going on for more than 150 years, and that the principal incubator of it is state and local government, which is the breeding ground for most of the corruption that finds itself arising to the federal level. And it extends into not just things like legislation, but also litigation, especially in states where judges are elected and are appointed by well-connected law firms. So the situation is pervasive at all levels of government, every state, it is requires a much more systematic approach than just regulating the fundraising activities of the members of Congress.
I would agree with you. You know, I point out in the book there's a practice in D.C. they call them milker bills, and it has nothing to do with the dairy industry. A milker bill is designed to milk campaign donations or lobbying gigs for family and friends. The term milker actually is one that originated in the Midwest because it was a process and continues to be in certain Midwestern states where you kind of milk donations. The same thing happens in California at the state and local level. They call them juicers there, juicer bills. So, you know, it's a reflection, I guess, on the local agriculture in the region of the country. I think you're exactly right. This does happen at the state and local level. I do believe that at the federal level, the stakes become much higher because the amount of money is much larger. The ability of the federal government to do something to you in terms of scope can be much larger as well, just in terms of their ability to, you know, FDA, healthcare laws, et cetera. And I also think that the distance that exists, the fact that federal government is so large and so complex and so distant geographically makes it easier to hide. I do think at a state legislative level, you can have instances where, and it takes a certain set of, you know, certain amount of bravery, there's no question about it, for a person to call out a local politician or a local member of the, you know, zoning commission or whatever it may be, where you can do that and you can really actually have an effect on that person's political fortunes. I think at the national level, there's so much noise, it's much harder to do that. You know, in terms of solutions, I think you're right. It's not just about campaign finance. It's a problem that's going to be inherent to government when you have government. The question is, can we do things to limit or to provide some elbow room for those who are targets for this behavior? And the ultimate solution, as I've talked about, I think I mentioned it today, is, you know, look, it's the size and scope of government. You know, Jefferson said it, Ronald Reagan echoed it, to the extent that government can do something to you, it can do something for you. And so as long as government and the scope of government is large and massive at a federal level, you are going to see this practice continue. And that is sort of the ultimate solution to this issue.
If I may follow up, are you aware that so-called campaign finance disclosure laws are used almost exclusively to mine donations? When I used to research campaign finance disclosures in the state capitals, I found other people researching it, and every single one of them was there to develop lists of prospective donors and the message was usually, you donated to my opponent, you better donate to me or else.
Yep. No, that does happen. There's no question about it. And a lot of, you can see this in the campaign patterns, and you can see this also when you interview ex-CEOs. They say, we just end up giving the maximum amount to both sides. It's basically protection money. You've got two rival gangs, and you just pay them both off, and that's the easiest way to approach it. So I agree with you, and again, I think a lot of the reforms that we've had since the 1970s, I would agree with, not all of them, but I would agree with them. But again, if one believes that the practice you're talking about in terms of, you know, you better give to me, you gave to my opponents, we need to look at ways in which we can regulate or restrict the behavior of the seller of influence, or the one that, in my mind, has the real leverage, which is the one with government power. And that's where I think our ideas need to be focused.
We've got two callers with questions pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Bob Zadek. I spoke a little earlier. Just a minor point. The book, The Three Felonies a Day, was written by Harvey Sliligate, just in case the audience is interested in the book. It was written about 2 or 3 years ago. The last point is, while, of course, business, big business primarily, does have to pay the bribe or the extortion money, it's pretty painless to big business because so long as all industry components are paying it, it just becomes a cost of doing business, and the victims are us people who are the end users of the product or service. It's totally neutral to the business. Banks were not very much harmed by this horrible Dodd-Frank bill because while it imposed enormous regulatory costs, the big banks who were involved in the process just passed it through. Of course, it was the community banks that take it in the chin because they can't afford the compliance costs. So to some degree, the cost is a society cost, not a cost to business.
Well, I agree with you when it comes to the large operators. There's no question, and Dodd-Frank's a good example of that. A lot of the large, big financial operators, by and large, embrace Dodd-Frank because smaller competitors who, as you point out, don't have the resources in terms of regulatory capabilities, et cetera, aren't able to compete. And so it's a way of actually limiting the marketplace further. And why I believe that, you know, oftentimes big business and big government in the popular media are sort of identified as, you know, locked in this epic battle against each other. I think you look at both of them, big corporations and big government, they like each other. Big corporations like to have a complex regulatory regime because young upstarts that don't have the resources are going to have a hard time meeting and matching what they can do. And I think when you look at it from the standpoint of regulators, you know, if you are a regulator of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, would you rather deal with 1,500 farmers or 15 farmers? So I agree with you, and particularly when you're talking about big operators, I think the people who really take it on the chin are the medium-sized or the growing entities who are trying to get
the entrepreneurs take it in the chin.
Yes, exactly.
And when you say big business and big government need each other, they're partners. I mean, they desperately need each other. One couldn't thrive without the other. So really, the split in society is not business versus government. It's big versus little.
Correct. Correct. And big, you know, in a sense, created by a monopoly encouraged by government. That's how I would characterize.
Peter, this is Dean Reuter. I imagine the dynamic changes a little bit when you're talking about regulations that affect even big businesses if they handicap those big businesses in the international markets.
Yes, absolutely. There's no question about that. And you're seeing that to a certain extent with Dodd-Frank, and you've seen that with some of the other financial regulations that, you know, the big operators, JP Morgan, I think the Citigroup CEO, you know, said when Dodd-Frank passed, he said, 85% of this we really like. But it does create implications and challenges when you're operating in a global marketplace. So yes, I would agree with you. The implications can be negative even for large corporations when you are operating at a global level, and other countries don't have the same sort of regulatory requirements or the same sort of regulatory approach.
Terrific. We've got a couple questions pending. Again, if you want to join the queue for questions, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Well, this is Cleta Mitchell. I'm a campaign finance lawyer for conservatives, Republicans, et cetera, in Washington. And I think you're mixing a number of different issues. I've been dealing with these issues for my entire career, 30, 40 years, both at the state and federal level. And I think, number one, the principle that you point out is that as more as government explodes in its regulation, people are going to get more interested in what government does and give money. The thing that bothers me about your book is I know that you have taken some factual liberties, because some of the things you've written about are about some of my clients, and they're just wrong. And
give me some examples if you're able to.
I don't want to spread a false statement any further than it's already been spread, but I just know I represent some of these leadership PACs, and I think that some of the things that you've said about them are just wrong. But the other thing I think that is important to do is understand that you keep talking about business. I mean, I don't know if you, I really don't know, and maybe this is a good part of a good journalist, that I don't know if you're a liberal or conservative. From my perspective, the more government does, the more people are going to be involved in who's elected and making decisions. But what you don't talk about is the labor union. And while the corporations may spread their money equally, the labor unions give 99.9% of their money to one party and one set of candidates. They are every bit as active as business, and they don't get voluntary contributions. Talk about extortion.
Yep.
People are required, in order to keep their jobs, to give to the labor unions. I don't know if you have a chapter on that, but I just know you've written some factually incorrect, very inflammatory kinds of things that get 60 Minutes all hyped up. But the real issue is the explosion of government and not trying to regulate campaign finance. You say you support the things that have been done since the 70s. Good God, that's what's gotten us into this mess. So I'm not really sure where you come down in all this. I just think that freedom and the opportunity for people to participate in the process, you know, however they want to, but without having their money taken from them involuntarily and all. I mean, but the main thing is you should get your facts right. That's the reason I tuned into this call.
Well, I first of all, I'm familiar with your work, and I have great respect for it. So thank you for calling. I would be glad if you wanted to share with me, maybe off the phone, if you wanted to do that, you know, what you think those things are. The you know, by and large, what we did on the Leadership Pack, if you're referring to the 60-minute story, is simply look through the expenses of how Leadership Pack funds were spent. And certainly, you know, they were contacted, but we can have that conversation separately if you'd like. I mean, I am a Reagan conservative libertarian, and I always have been. My view, when I say that the approach for the last 40 years, I certainly don't endorse. I think McCain-Feingold is a disaster. I think that Citizens United is a decision that I wholeheartedly support, because I do believe that money is speech. My issue is not at all if a individual has strong beliefs that, you know, whether that is we need a strong national defense or, you know, environmental regulations, whatever. I believe that individuals should be able to spend their money to voice their issues on their concern. My concern is when you find individuals in business who say, look, I really don't want to get involved in politics, but I don't have a choice, because I have to, and that there are things done nationally that are designed, in effect, to force businesses or to strongly encourage businesses to get involved in giving campaigns and hiring lobbyists when they really don't want to. There's no question that they do it voluntarily, and they should, and I don't favor restrictions on those. But I think that when it comes to the politician side, we have to view this, you know, in economics they call it public choice theory, but we have to recognize that politics, in a lot of respects, functions like a business. And politicians, a lot of them, not all of them, a lot of them and people in the bureaucracy are looking for opportunities to increase demand for their services. And so they function that way, whether it's legislatively, whether it's, you know, in the regulatory sphere, et cetera. So that is my worldview as it relates to it. And what I said was that I do believe, you know, a cap on an individual contribution that one person can give to a candidate, I do think there should be a cap there. I don't think that should be unlimited. But I do think that if an individual, you know, has a super PAC or wants to have a C-4, I certainly don't believe in any regulations on those at all. That is a First Amendment right. I think when you're talking about an individual contribution to a politician, it's not just a real issue related to the First Amendment. It relates to the issue of influence, and I think there should be some cap there.
Very good. We've got just 5 minutes left, 4 minutes left now, and we have a hard stop at 2 o'clock, or 1 o'clock rather. I'm going to try and get to as many of these calls as possible. I've got two pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is John Shortino from Maryland. And I first wanted to thank Mr. Schweitzer and the Federalist Society for an incredibly interesting and quite depressing talk this afternoon. My question is, if there were a Jimmy Stewart in 2013, a person who is genuinely interested in making good public policy and not just getting reelected or financing his lifestyle and all that stuff, given the system that you've described with leadership PACs and committee dues and all that stuff, would he have any prayer of being an effective lawmaker?
I think they can be. I think that, you know, there are effective lawmakers up there. And I don't think that, you know, I think a leadership PAC, for example, is certainly a form of fundraising that can be helpful. I mean, people should be able to help elect people that share their ideas. I think the problem is when you get sort of in this slippery slope of looking at one's position as an opportunity for self-enrichment. I mean, I mentioned this in the book. I mentioned it and Throw Them All Out. I still, for the life of me, cannot understand why we continue to allow sitting members of Congress or in the Senate to have immediate family members that are registered lobbyists. And I know there's ways around that. You can just say I'm in government affairs, I'm not a lobbyist. But the notion that there is no restriction, and I highlight in the book, you know, two examples, one Republican, one Democrat. Harry Reid, Senator, of course, from Nevada, Senator Roy Blunt from Missouri, Republican, who have multiple family members that are registered lobbyists. And when you talk to people in those states, it's pretty clear if you want something done, you've got to go through those families. So I think you can be effective. I am by nature an optimist. I think that there are some good people out there. I think that, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. I don't think that people should get disengaged, but I do think we need to kind of step back and take a larger picture as how are we approaching these issues and what is the transaction that takes place between, you know, money flowing into Washington. A lot of that is voluntary. People, you know, want to do it. They're passionate about their ideas. They have concerns. They want to have their interests represented, and that is certainly good. But there are a lot of people who will say, I don't want to be involved in this, but I'm being put into a position where I have to be. And we can't just – the analogy I use is you can't discuss professional sports in the United States without looking at the business side of it. And it's the same thing with politics. You can't look at policy issues and policy debates without looking at the question of, you know, are people in D.C. or you know, these politicians or these bureaucrats trying to create a demand for their services? I just don't think you can look at it. And so we have to have a more multi-layered approach. And I'm certainly not doom and gloom. We have to be optimistic, and I think both sides we should encourage to have sort of a zero-tolerance policy for, you know, blatant self-enrichment. Even if there's somebody that you agree with on all the issues, if they're engaged in blatant self-enrichment, I mean, we need to step up and say, you know, we shouldn't tolerate this, and I'm not going to support that individual.
Well, with apologies to our final caller with a question, I'm afraid we're going to have to suspend the call. Lee, do you have a final thought, or do you want to wrap up before we adjourn the call?
Thank you so much. I just want to thank all the callers for their excellent points. And Peter, for your wonderful book. So many times we are seeing things out of the corner of our eye, but when somebody gathers it all together and focuses on it and documents it the way you have, it's a very, very valuable service. About our caller who thinks it's kind of depressing, I'm with you, Peter. I am an optimist. And I think it's important also to note that whereas there is a great deal of criticism in your book, there are many, many lawmakers who are not doing these things. What you have done is illuminate what is possible under the current system and what is being done under the current system by some, and therefore is enabling us to address it. So I thank you for that and for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation very much and appreciate all that the Federalist Society is trying to do.
And let me add my thanks as well to Lee O'Connor and Peter Schweitzer, author of Extortion, How Politicians Extract Your Money, Buy Votes, and Line Their Own Pockets. To our audience, I encourage you to check our website for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. And until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.